today on Against the Grain. What do college athletes, prison laborers, welfare recipients, and graduate students in the sciences have in common? According to sociologist Erin Hatton, they're all workers who face a particular form of coercion. She joins me to discuss what these workers' circumstances tell us about work under contemporary capitalism. She'll also consider the situation of prisoners pressured into dangerous work during the coronavirus. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Work in America has changed significantly over the last 40 years, including the switch from more secure jobs to temporary ones. Less noted, however, has been the increasing role of coercion in our work lives, especially for some jobs and some populations. Erin Hatton is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Buffalo, and she's the author of Coerced, Work Under the Threat of Punishment. Erin, as many critics have noted, most of us give up a great deal of our rights when we go to work. How do you define status coercion, and does it differ from what most of us experience?
Sure, that's a great question. So, in fact, there are different types of coercion, which can be in operation separately or even together. So the kind of most basic, ubiquitous type of coercion that we all experience to some degree is typically known as economic coercion. And this simply refers to the Hobson's choice, or really the false choice that we are presented with between working and not working, between working and starvation, right? Because we must work in order to get by and feed and support our families in a capitalist system, then we do tend to face some degree of economic coercion in getting work and in keeping work. And this, you know, tends to give employers quite a bit of power in the workplace, especially for workers who are more vulnerable. But the type of coercion that I talk about in my book is different from economic coercion, because the lever of power that bosses have over their workers isn't about money, which is really at the base of economic coercion, employers' ability to kind of hire and fire and promote and demote workers or cut their hours, take away their wages in some way. The type of coercion that I talk about is different. I call it status coercion, because it revolves around bosses' power to remove workers from a particular status, that status comes with rights and privileges and benefits and opportunities. And so because they have power over their status, they also have power over workers' access to all of those rights and benefits and privileges and opportunities.
So you focus on four groups, which we'll talk about in this hour: prisoners, workfare workers, college athletes, graduate students doing research in the sciences. But before we get to sort of the nitty-gritty of what they have in common and why you think it's significant, I wonder if you could discuss for us the way that work is seen in moralistic terms in the U.S. If you could just trace for us some of the history of how we've come to think of work the way we do.
Sure. So work in our country and in many other cultures, but I would say especially in American culture, work is very much prized. It's very much valued. It's seen as one of the primary sources of value and dignity. It is hard to walk around with real standing in our culture without having a good job. Holding your head up with pride and telling people what you do at a social event, for example, right? Work is a really important source of pride and dignity and belonging. And people who don't have that type of work or don't have access to that type of work suffer in not only in economic terms, but in other ways as well. And throughout American history, there have been lots of times where we see that the morality of work imbued in policy. So, for example, in the history of the welfare state, and even before the welfare state came to be, an arm of the state when it was when charities were primarily doled out by churches, there was a great bit of moralism determining who got help and how much they would be helped and what do they need to do in order to receive that help. So in American poorhouses, for example, which were often run by churches and other such nonprofit agencies that we would call them today, they were very strict. You couldn't, you had to work. You had to contribute to the house in some way. You couldn't break any of the rules, many of which were kind of moral codes, such as drinking or lying or going out too much. So it was the whole kind of rhetoric around who got help, who deserved to be helped, was this kind of moral rhetoric, and it really centered on work. And much of our notions of who deserves help in our country revolve around whether they can and should be working for wages. And if we think that they can and should be, then we don't give them help. So there's a lot of moralism in our kind of cultural rhetoric and in our cultural policies, our state policies, around things like welfare and other regulations about what we expect from people. And what we expect from them is to be productive workers.
Well, tell us more about welfare and the shift which happened under Bill Clinton that demanded that those who received welfare had to work in order to get benefits. Tell us about the situation that those workers find themselves in and how that work really isn't classified as work proper.
That's right. So in 1996, there was a kind of major overhaul of our welfare system, what's widely known as welfare reform. And lots of different rules were put in place about who could get what and how much they could get. And the whole law really centered on personal responsibility, by which they really meant work. And so people were now expected more than ever. There were some work programs already in place, but people were now expected more than ever to participate in, quote, work activities in order to gain access to the social safety net. And so this typically meant that if you would come to the welfare office, you would go through 1,000 different hoops trying to obtain some small amount of cash or assistance or rental vouchers or electric bill vouchers for you and your family. In order to get that assistance, you would have to apply to so many jobs in so many days. If you did not, by the end of, let's say, 30 or 60 days, get any job, you would be then assigned to a work activities program. So this might mean you then go to a work crew, you have to take 2 buses across the city, go to this nonprofit agency where they will then drive you out to parks where you pick up trash for a few hours, and then they take you back, then you take your 2 buses home where you need to pick up your child. Your child is in subsidized childcare, but only for the hours that you're assigned to do those work activities, which effectively means that you have no time to actually find paying employment, because those work activities are not legally construed as employment. You do get access to the social safety net, which may or may not include cash benefits, but you don't get hourly wages. And so you do this labor, but it's denigrated as not real work. And you don't qualify for all of the labor and employment protections that, quote, real workers qualify for. And so these workfare workers, it's often called workfare, these workfare workers are caught in kind of a catch-22. They feel very much stuck. They must do these work activities to provide for their family, if only meagerly, because in point of fact, the social safety net is very, very meager indeed. And yet they have no opportunity. It's entirely constraining for them to be able to find better real waged work to really provide for their families.
And as you point out, the situation of people doing workfare has something in common with one of the most reviled groups of people in society, which is prisoners. And you focus on New York State, where all able-bodied prisoners are expected, or required in fact, to work. Tell us about the situation of prisoners and work.
That's right. So for most prisoners across the U.S., they are expected to perform some type of labor. Now, not all prisons have capacity to put prisoners to work in an effective way, but for the most part, they are required to be productive. And if they, quote, choose not to, they will face punishments in some form. Maybe they won't get privileges. Maybe they won't get be able to buy things from the commissary, edible food, for example. Or maybe they won't be able to have family visits, right? So they can't precisely force them to work, but they effectively do. And so, yes, all able-bodied prisoners are required to work. And by comparing them to workfare workers, I do not mean to suggest in any way that welfare recipients are in prison or are forced to work in the same way that prisoners are required to work. But they do face a similar set of severe consequences from their bosses if they run into trouble on the job. So as I talk about in the book, prisoners' bosses, who are also corrections officers, they have a lot of power over them. So if a prisoner doesn't comply with a direct order from a CO, a corrections officer, that CO is fully enabled to impose any number of punishments on them. They can fine them, they can give them a ticket, which means they give them a fine of usually about a week's wages. They can put them on keep lock, which means that they're confined to their cell and they lose all privileges. And these privileges are immensely important, right? It's access to food, it's access to recreation, it's access to family. And then most severe, they can put them in solitary confinement, which means they're confined to an enclosed and segregated cell, usually for 23 hours a day, without human interaction. The consequences of this, well, many bioethicists regard this as torture. Long-term solitary confinement is torture because we are social beings, right? And taking away that social connection is in fact torturous, and it has long-term physical and mental health consequences on prisoners who are kept in solitary confinement. And yet, there are no limits in the U.S. on the amount of time that prisoners can be kept in solitary. And remember, as I argue in my book, officers can put prisoners in solitary for basically any reason, anytime they go against a direct order. Now, this order could be to pick up a piece of paper in the hallway in your boxers. If you don't do it, you're not complying with the direct order, and you can be sent to solitary. Now, as prisoners would point out to me, corrections officers are not all bad, not by a long shot. But those who do decide to abuse their power, there are very little controls on that type of abuse. And these officers are overseeing their lives, but they're also overseeing their labor. And so this is why I talk about this as a form of labor coercion, this type of expansive punitive power officers have over prisoners. Now, in workfare supervisors and caseworkers have a kind of similar form of expansive punitive power. Because if workfare workers don't comply with what their bosses say, and again, really, it could be almost anything. Noncompliance itself is a sanctionable offense. If you're sanctioned, that means you're cut off from public assistance. That means that you lose anything that you're getting, your cash benefits, your vouchers, your rental subsidies, you lose that. Maybe for the first offense, it's for 30 days. But under TANF, which is that 1996 welfare law, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, under TANF, your lifetime allotment of welfare benefits keeps going on even when you're sanctioned, even when you're cut off. So as a result, when they're sanctioned, welfare recipients and their families can be pushed into homelessness. Or, get this, if they're already living in a homeless shelter and they're on welfare and they're going to work and for one reason or another they don't comply or can't comply or the bureaucracy confuses them so they somehow end up not complying or they're accused of not complying for whatever reason, they can be sanctioned. And if they're sanctioned while in a homeless shelter, they'll be kicked out of the homeless shelter and put onto the street. This is the type of expansive punitive power that bosses wield in these jobs.
And as one of the prisoners who you talked to said that while on the one hand, the kind of labor that prisoners are obligated to do in the same way that welfare recipients are obligated to do, on the other hand, they don't have any of the recourses that someone would have under other circumstances, at least in theory, you know, being able to call in sick, or if you're lucky, have union representation. So that question of the kind of collective power people can wield on the job is really stripped back. Although you do also argue that people do find ways to resist, and I wonder, we'll come back to this, but if you could give us some idea of how people who are dealing with workfare or prison labor both see their situation and also how they resist, whether individually or collectively.
That's right. These workers do resist, and they do so in a multitude of ways. I mean, well, first I should say that these levers of power their bosses wield of them are quite strong. And so most of the time these workers comply. But they also push back. They push back when they feel that their personal dignity, their sense of self-respect is at risk, and also when their colleagues, their coworkers are at risk. They push back, and sometimes they even organize at great risk for themselves and their lives. So just quickly, the most common way that these two groups sought to resist maybe those nastier bosses is what I call a strategy of avoidance, right? They would go to great lengths to kind of avoid the nastier bosses so that they wouldn't have to deal with them, so that they wouldn't be punished, so that they could keep their bodies safe in the case of prisoners, so that they could keep their families out of peril in the case of workfare workers. So they would do what they needed to do to get it done, but they wouldn't engage. They would kind of ignore, which is indeed a form of resistance because they're not even supposed to ignore. They need to play by whatever rules officers and workfare supervisors set for them, including joking and pretending they're friends. But some of them, at least, pushed back and refused to engage in that way, did what they needed to do while maintaining their sense of dignity while living and working behind bars or for workfare.
I'm speaking with sociologist Erin Hatton. She is the author of Coerced: Work Under the Threat of Punishment. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been discussing workfare workers and prisoners who are obligated to work, but you also focus on two other groups, graduate students in the sciences, which we'll talk about in a moment, but also college athletes. And I wonder if you could tell us now, you know, in many ways you could say that the situation of college athletes is miles removed from the situation of prisoners and of welfare recipients. And of course, you make that point yourself. But how should we see college athletes as another example of workers who are working under coercion?
That's right. I do want to emphasize the point that these two student groups are miles apart from those two other groups, right? They are not criminalized the same way. They are not marginalized in the same way. They are not socially disadvantaged in the same way. They are miles apart. And of course, they're not living under lock and key as our prisoners, literally risking their lives in some cases and losing their sanity in solitary confinement. It is a very, very different situation. That said, I do argue in the book that all of these very different types of workers experience some degree of this type of coercion that I'm talking about. So it's kind of like the analogy would be low-level, maybe day laborers and middle-class managers, right? Both of those types of workers experience economic coercion to some degree. They both need to work and need to do well, need to keep their bosses happy in order to keep their jobs and provide for their families. But the degree of their vulnerability to economic coercion, the consequences for them if that coercion is wielded against them are vastly different. And so that's the kind of similar dispersion across these groups. Now, for student athletes, so many things about their lives are on the line in their sport. And I do conceptualize their work as Division I athletes. So I studied Division I football players and Division I basketball players. and these two revenue-generating sports, these athletes are working many, many long hours. Despite the caps put on the number of hours that they can work for the NCAA, they are working well beyond those caps. And their bodies really are on the line. Oftentimes they're getting injured. They're not being able to engage in the schoolwork in the way that at least some of them would really, really like to do. They're not able to take the majors that they would like to do. They're giving their all to their sport because that is what's asked of them. And that's also what they want. They love their sport. But their coaches have the ability to take it all away. If an athlete doesn't do what a coach says, if an athlete, say, goes to a meeting with a mental health counselor instead of going to practice one day, then that athlete may not be played in that game Friday night. Now, for most of us who aren't in the world of sports, that may not sound like that big a deal. But for these athletes, it's a very big deal. They've worked oftentimes most of their lives to play the sport. Playing their sport at this elite level, at a Division I competitively ranked university, this is the highest that they're going to go. Most athletes do not go on to play professionally. This is it. This is the apex of their athletic career. They're working day in, day out to make it happen. And they have a finite number of games in any given season and a finite number of seasons that they can play. Losing any one of those is terrible for them. It's a huge consequence. But it's not only that. It's not only losing playing time, though that's big in and of itself, but they could also lose a chance to play professionally. Because, in fact, they're only recruited for professional opportunities, for those few lucky ones who do get to go on to play professionally. They're only recruited by watching them play. And so if they're not playing, they're not going to be recruited. And also, just as in graduate school, coaches act as informal recommenders to professional recruiters. And if the athletes told me again and again, if they didn't fall in line, if they weren't a good soldier, if they weren't coachable, if they didn't do what the coach said at any point, including if they didn't play while they were injured, then they were terrified that the coach wouldn't recommend them to recruiters, that they would say that they're uncoachable, that they're a bad seed, a bad apple, that they wouldn't be a good team player. And so coaches wield a great deal of power over these athletes' kind of present and future athletic careers. And then also, finally, the last lever of power they wield is their scholarships, because they can essentially revoke athletes' scholarships and therefore revoke their access to subsidized university education.
Which would be a dire consequence indeed. Well, tell us about another group of students who play a different role in the universities, and that's graduate students in the sciences who do the research work. Maybe you could first start by just explaining for us how the role that graduate students play in the sciences in research for universities as a whole.
Sure, yeah. In fact, it's remarkably important, and it's quite different from many other disciplines. So in my own discipline of sociology, for example, graduate students take on their own research agenda. They decide what they want to do for their dissertations. They do the research. They will have taken classes from faculty. They may have worked as a TA or a research assistant under a faculty member, but they're not doing their own research under a faculty member. And then they write their dissertations. They publish, perhaps with help from their advisor, and they graduate and move on. Now, their advisor does write them letters of recommendation, which are very important. In the sciences, it's quite different from all of this. Science graduate students are essentially doing their faculty advisor's research. So sometime in their first year in graduate school, science PhD students need to choose a lab. And by choosing a lab, they're essentially choosing a faculty advisor who is also their boss, and they're choosing a research agenda. And in that lab, you basically do your advisor's research. You are the hands that do the experiments. This is what they told me again and again. So while your faculty advisor will kind of set the research agenda, the faculty advisor spends his or her time getting grants to keep the lab up and running, and they may have weekly or biweekly meetings with the students to kind of make sure everyone's on track, answer any questions, troubleshoot any issues. The students, along with the postdocs, are the ones who are in the lab doing the research. And anything that they do in that lab is owned by the faculty advisor, right? It's not their own research. It is owned by their advisor. And they often call their advisor their boss. Like, this is recognized in this situation, that this is really a labor relation. And so any publications that may come out of it, any patents or inventions that may come out of it, are entirely owned by the faculty advisor. The advisor also determines who gets to be on a publication. I don't know if you know, but in the sciences, they often have a long list of authors.
Sure.
The last one on that list is the advisor, the one who owns the lab. Well, that advisor gets to determine who's on that list and what order that list comes in, which is a great deal of power and can determine that the whole career of a graduate student, because your publications can determine whether you graduate at all in some departments and certainly what kind of jobs you get. So they're in the lab, they're doing the experiment, working under their advisor, but also working for their advisor. And of course, their advisor's whole career depends on the labor of their graduate students.
And so why are these students, given everything you've just said, that they do the work that makes all of this happen? Why are they not seen as workers and given the protections that workers would have under other circumstances?
Well, for all of the groups of workers that I study, they have been carved out of labor and employment law in various ways. And lots of other groups are carved out of labor and employment laws in various ways as well. But these, the two student groups, for example, there have been recent court cases that have challenged this contention, but by and large, they have been deemed to be primarily students by the courts. And as such, they are not seen as workers. And so again and again, the courts have asserted and the universities have asserted that they are getting something from this work. Yes, they have to do some stuff, perhaps as part of their graduate education, but the stuff they're doing is about learning. It's not about work. And therefore, this is not an economic relationship. And as such, they are not entitled to things like, well, minimum wage, overtime, healthcare benefits, though most graduate students nowadays do get a basic stipend and health benefits. They are not necessarily entitled to union representation and collective bargaining. They don't have HR departments to turn to when things go bad in the workplace, or if things go bad in the workplace, or if, for example, their advisor, who is also their boss, is harassing them. There's nowhere to turn.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Erin Hatton about her book, Coerced, Work Under the Threat of Punishment. That's published by the University of California Press, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. She's associate professor in sociology at the University of Buffalo. Well, of the four groups that you've been discussing, that is prisoners and prison laborers, workfare recipients, college athletes, and then graduate students, particularly in the sciences. Of those, three of those four are categories that tend to be highly racialized in this country. And I wondered if you could talk about the role of race. Is it just an accident that three out of four of these groups are situations that tend to be associated, whether rightly or not, with African Americans, or whether something else is going on here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would certainly argue that, in fact, all of these groups of workers are racialized in one way or another. But as you noted, three of the four are racialized as Black, as African American, while graduate students are racialized as white. Though, of course, there's lots of diversity within each of these workforces, let's call them. And so obviously not all prisoners are Black, not by a long shot. Is it a coincidence? Yes and no. I would argue on the one hand that in fact this type of coercion that I'm talking about is in a lot of different places, much more than we might otherwise realize. And so that even quote unquote regular workers experience status coercion to a certain degree. So it's not necessarily that this kind of especially punitive form of coercion is relegated to more disadvantaged workforces or sectors of the population. But I do think that the more punitive forms that this type of coercion takes, even while being still entirely socially acceptable, it is not a coincidence that we see that in highly socially marginalized populations. And so in the book, I do talk about how, for example, the first two groups, the prisoners who work behind bars and welfare recipients who have to work in order to receive welfare assistance, these two groups are criminalized both in American popular culture as well as in public policy to a large degree. And so they're seen as problems to be solved, problems to be regulated, people who are going to break the law. In the case of welfare recipients, they're seen as frauders, right? They're trying to take advantage of the system unfairly. So they need to be policed. They need to be disciplined. They need to be governed. They need to be controlled. And we use this rhetoric of criminalization to justify this kind of expansive punitive power that I'm talking about in my book, so that it seems okay to the American public that an officer can put a prisoner in solitary confinement if they don't do what they say. We see that as justifiable because they are bad people, we presume. Same with workfare workers. Because we assume them to be defrauding the system, and we've kind of bought this rhetoric wholesale since really the late 1970s as an American public, then we see it as reasonable for them to be policed in this way, for them to be mandated to work, because we presume that they would not otherwise work, that they do not otherwise want to work, which is entirely contrary to the truth, by the way. And so they need to be governed in this way, forced to work, and punished severely if something goes wrong. Now, for the other two groups, student athletes are an interesting case, right? Because they are, at least the basketball players and football players, are vastly disproportionately non-white groups housed uneasily within this white institution. And so they have this kind of strange space in American culture. Oftentimes, as a result, I think of their racial minority status as a group, although obviously they're not all racial minorities, we see them as lucky. They are seen as lucky to be where they are, to get this chance. And if they don't take advantage of it, if they don't basically do whatever we want them to do, whatever coaches tell them to do, then we see it as reasonable that they should be punished. They're lucky. In fact, I as part of my research for this book, I read a football handbook from Northwestern University that was part of a court case that was made part of the public record. And one of the things from that handbook really stuck out at me. It was this kind of long list of sometimes very mean Twitter tips for the athletes. And one of them said something like, don't go on Twitter to complain about your life. Thousands of other kids would crawl through glass to be where you are today. And they were basically saying, suck it up. We don't want to hear it. If you don't like it, you can leave and we'll get someone else. They're treating them as disposable. But all the while they're treating them as disposable, they're also using this rhetoric of privilege. You're lucky to be here. You are privileged. And many of the athletes, at least initially, fully believed it. They felt lucky. It was a great privilege. But then, oftentimes, at least, by the end of their athletic careers, I usually interviewed them not long after they had graduated from school or left school. By the end, they at least sometimes left with a pretty sour taste in their mouth, because they had bought that rhetoric of privilege, they had bought the rhetoric of family and the coaches really caring about them, and by the end, many of them came to believe that their coaches really didn't care, that their coaches were out to make a paycheck, and they were using them to get that paycheck however they could, even if it meant risking their bodies.
Well, it seems like that moralism is just absolutely pervasive in complicating how people see coercion, both as, you know, the public at large and then people who are the recipients of it. But one dimension that you write about is the notion that these people, in whichever way this is accepting the graduate students, are a drain on taxpayers. And therefore, it seems like that moralism becomes a sort of two-way problem, in that that's the message that these people, these workers, are getting. But also, as you've noted, often they seem to end up believing it, or some of them do anyway.
Sure. And frankly, it's not surprising they believe it, because these messages are pervade American culture. And so it's absolutely the case that those three groups of workers, the prisoners, the workfare workers, and the student athletes, are told again and again, explicitly and implicitly, that they're kind of, for the first two groups, they deserve any punishment they get, they need to be policed. And for student athletes, they're lucky to be where they are, and we need to control you to keep you in line. And if you don't stay in line, you're out. You're out in a second on your butt. And there's also this kind of overt, even among those student athletes, even within this rhetoric of privilege and lucky to be there, there is this sense of moralism. There is this sense of we need to regulate you, we need to control you. Almost they use the, I need to be your big brother, meaning I'm going to be watching you every minute. I'm going to be trolling your Twitter account. I'm going to be looking at your other social media accounts. I'm going to make your teammates do the same. And if someone tells on you, you're out. You're out for the game, you're out for the season, you're out. If you embarrass us, you're out. And so there is still overt punitive tones with which they kind of regulate these students' lives and their bodies.
You also write that beyond these obviously racialized associations, that gender also plays a part in how we think of these workers, how these workers think of themselves. Can you talk about that?
Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that the type of punishments we find to be acceptable in each of these workplaces are shaped by the kind of race and gender characteristics of these organizations. So, for instance, because in American culture, prisons are seen as these black masculine spaces, in part because there is kind of certainly prison populations are disproportionately non-white and male, but not only, right? That's not the only reason. We have the stereotype of the space as this menacing, criminal, black male space, the scary space. As a result of that raced and gendered social construction of the prison, then it becomes acceptable in the American cultural imagination to force prisoners to work under threat of solitary confinement, to put them in solitary confinement, not for days, but for weeks, not for weeks sometimes, but for years, to put them in solitary confinement for not complying with an order. Do we oversee what kind of orders they're not complying with? No, we know. There's very little regulation about the reasons why they can be put in solitary confinement. And those charges for why they can be put in solitary are easily trumped up. So the argument here is that the kind of raced and gendered character of the organization itself, the institution, is part of what helps justify the types of punishments those bosses can wield. So likewise, the welfare system is often seen as kind of the feminized counterpart to the criminal justice system. And so this, by virtue of policy, is a disproportionately female population, right? Only people who have for the most part, only people who have children in the homes are allowed to get access to the welfare state in this way. And they are also disproportionately non-white, though not by a long stretch are all welfare recipients non-white. In fact, most welfare recipients in this country are still white. Even still, because as an American culture, the welfare system is now seen as this non-white, feminized space, the types of punishments, the types of controls that caseworkers and workfare supervisors can exert over welfare recipients is shaped by that race and class designation, the type of punitive power they can wield, the ability to kick families out of homeless shelters, the ability to kick them off welfare altogether. This type of punitive power, I argue, is justified because, at least in part, welfare is feminized and racialized as non-white.
Sociologist Erin Hatton is my guest. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So, Erin, I'd like to step back and look at this kind of coarse labor, which you see as particularly around the question of status. I want to ask you how you feel we should be including this in the ways that we see labor under capitalism today. There's been a lot of focus on how workers have become very precarious under what is called neoliberalism since the 1970s to the present. and that the, you know, the switch toward the gig economy, how people don't have careers the way they used to, that people find themselves in temporary contract work. But you argue that as important is this dimension of coercion, and in fact, it helps us better to understand the whole dimension of precarity. Can you explain why?
Sure. Well, there are a couple things going on. One point is that these, I want to really kind of expand our view. We really have been kind of focused on this one dimension of power that bosses can wield and that which makes workers vulnerable. It's this economic power, right? And certainly with the neoliberalization of the American economy and with the degradation of workplace standards and working conditions for many workers, the increased precarity for so many workers, this new vulnerability to economic insecurity is pervasive and extremely important. And so it makes this kind of economic coercion, the power that bosses can wield over their workers, it makes it even more important. And all I'm saying is that I want to step back and look at the other levers of power that bosses can wield, these levers of powers which we haven't been paying attention to. And in fact, because they often work together to compound workers' disadvantage. So for example, many of these workers, through the type of coercion that I'm talking about, are kind of primed to accept substandard, precarious work when they leave their current position as a prisoner or a welfare recipient or a graduate student. They're then primed to go on and accept kind of crappy work, precarious work in the mainstream economy. So, you know, prisoners told me that one guy was like, how can I not accept, basically what he meant was a crappy job, a fast food job, a stepping stone. How can I not accept it when I was working for 10 cents an hour in prison, right? So the type of work that they were doing behind bars, the terrible wages they got, and though, by the way, New York State prisoners do get wages, whereas in many other states they don't, and also the power their bosses wielded over them, all of that made them ready to accept pretty substandard work in the mainstream economy when they got out. Same with at the other end of the spectrum for graduate students. Graduate students in the sciences leave with a PhD, you know, an elite pedigree for sure. But for most of them in the sciences, they must now get a postdoc. And postdocs are now lasting not just 2 years, not just 3 years, but more like 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 years. They are effectively stuck in these jobs that do not have long-term economic stability and are paid wages that do not meet the level of their experience and education. So in both of these ways, the kind of coercive labor conditions that I'm talking about, which are around status coercion, also help prime these workers to accept precarious jobs in the mainstream economy. So these levers of coercion can be combined to increase workers' vulnerability.
I want to return to the question of how workers see their situation and how they resist. You had been talking about examples with prisoners and welfare recipients, but are there any observations you can make, even lessons to draw from the ways that workers resisted these arrangements, given what you're saying about actually how pervasive coercion is in this society?
Well, at the heart of it, there needs to be checks on employers' power. So in the case of economic coercion, we do at least have some understanding in our society that bosses should not be able to control entirely a whole family's livelihoods. So we put some kind of checks and balances. We put some safety nets in place, however meager. So if an employee gets fired, or well, let's say laid off, they can get unemployment insurance. There is a safety net to catch them, again, however meager, and it is pretty meager as we're all finding out right now. But there is a safety net to catch them to kind of mitigate bosses' powers of economic coercion over them. But that's not the case for these other types of workers. These other workers who do not have access to these traditional labor employment protections, right? They don't have access to unemployment insurance if they lose their status as a Division I football player, if they lose their status as a graduate student or a working prisoner. So at the very least, there needs to be kind of mechanisms put in place to mitigate bosses' power, just as we've done with a social safety net to catch workers if they lose their jobs. There also needs to be some recourse of action for these workers when problems arise in the workplace. So although HR departments do not work perfectly in regular workplaces, right, there is at least some place where workers can go, hopefully anonymously, to discuss problems that arise if they're having a real problem with a boss, for example. They need to be able to go to see what their course of their recourse is, what the options are, to complain, to file some sort of grievance. Especially for the two student groups of student workers in my study, they had no idea where they could turn when a problem came up in the workplace. And they did face problems, but there was just literally no one they could go to because they would always face blowback, they believed. Their coach would always hear. Their advisor would always know. And so there was just nowhere they could turn. And while the workfare workers and prisoners did ostensibly have a mechanism for filing a grievance, that these mechanisms have come about through worker activism in these two institutions, they're very, very imperfect mechanisms. And as one prisoner told me, yeah, you can file a grievance, sure, but you're grieving the same people who grieved you. And so they did see them as a mechanism for complaining, but not as a mechanism for justice. And so what these workers need, and all workers need, really, is a robust mechanism for justice when abuses take place in the workplace. Their bosses shouldn't have full rein to be abusive.
Are there examples you can point to of these workers organizing themselves into unions, obviously a very different prospect for someone in prison than a graduate student?
None of the workers that I interviewed had actively taken part in a union effort per se, but that's not to say that they hadn't taken collective action. So behind bars, for instance, a former prisoner told me about a situation where one of their friends, one of their coworkers, was mistreated. And these were all workers who were working in the mess hall, the prison cafeteria, where they would get up early, serve food all morning long, and work quite hard. And so as to protest their coworkers' mistreatment, the next day, when the whole prison filed in for breakfast, the workers stood back against the wall and refused to serve food. And he said, oh, it was chaos, everyone crazy, people were jumping over the counter, serving themselves, it was a mess, it was chaos. And they felt justified. They had kind of made their case. They had asserted their view of their friends, their coworkers' mistreatment. But of course, they were also severely punished. They were sent to solitary confinement immediately, and then eventually all those organizers were dispersed. They were sent, all of them sent to different prisons across New York State and separated from each other and sent long distances from their families back home.
Erin, I'd like to end by asking you about what you're calling status coercion. During these unusual times that we find ourselves living through with the coronavirus and much of the economy shut down, but some essential workers being put in pretty vulnerable positions to try and keep the rest of us with food and so on. Are there any observations you would make about the situation of certain workers with this kind of status coercion right now?
Well, so many workers, so many people are suffering right now, and all lots of different forces are coming together to compound people's suffering. So the mass unemployment is devastating, and it's devastating foremost economically, but also for people's sense of dignity and accomplishment. As I talked about before, work is incredibly important in our culture, and I'm not against work. I love my work. I find a great bit of value and meaning in my work, and what I would hope for is for all workers to have access to that. But when people lose that in this unemployment crisis, for example, it's absolutely devastating, far above and beyond the economic imposition on them, which is also devastating. So lots of workers are suffering, and for all of those workers who are now deemed to be essential, and they are, it's so interesting because for so long, these service workers have been seen as disposable, replaceable. We can pay them the minimum wage because they're unskilled and they don't matter. And now suddenly this crisis is making it clear just how important they are and how essential they are to our service economy. But in so doing, they are also being put at great risk. But they're not the only ones being put at great risk, although I'm fearful of the types of risks that they are being put under and the strain they're putting under and the fear that they have to labor under, the fear of this deadly virus. But it's also true that prisoners are being put in that position as well. So they are being coerced, I should say, to work at times making or packaging hand sanitizer for others to use, but they don't get access to it themselves. Meanwhile, the virus is spreading throughout prisons because there is no possibility for social distancing in prisons. And then they're being asked now, just outside of New York City, to dig mass graves for victims of the coronavirus. They are being paid for this work, but it's a coercive wage, right? Because they don't make those wages otherwise. So they're putting their bodies at risk to do this horrendous work. And they go back to the prison where they're almost certainly gonna catch the virus and be exposed to this. It is a deadly and dreadful situation. But that's certainly an acute instance of a much broader problem through which this virus, this public health crisis and this economic crisis is exposing all of the cracks in our system, all of the disadvantages and inequalities that were already in place. It's making them so much more visible and so much worse for the people who are living them.
Erin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Erin Hatton. She is the author of Coerced, Work Under the Threat of Punishment. That's out from the University of California Press and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to her book. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Buffalo. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.